Thank you, judges. May it please the court. I've raised a number of issues on in my brief, but I'm going to focus the court first on loss amount. The fact that Ms. Maitrey was convicted of conspiracy should not lead to a loss amount that includes everything that her co-conspirators were attributed to. So essentially, factually here, there's two incidents. There's a November 12th, 2014 search of her home that she cohabitates with her boyfriend, Willie Smith. And in that event, there are 1,348 access devices located in the attic of that house, squirreled away. Mm-hmm. On January 7th, there's another incident. And in that event, there's 196 access devices located. The court found her liable for all of the approximately 1,540 access devices. Mm-hmm. Under 1B1.3, the court needs to look at the scope of her conduct to determine whether or not that should be attributed on the November 12th. The jury found her not guilty of any of the actual events of November 12th. She was actually not even arrested, so the police on that day did not even feel there was enough information attributing to her to arrest her for that. Mind you, the conspiracy count covered the entire time period, but the actions attributed to her are really pertinent to January 7th. Additionally,
I know acquitted conduct is a controversial proposition, but it's pretty clear under the case law that a district court can, despite an acquittal on a count like that, find by preponderance of the evidence that this is relevant conduct, right?
Yes, I think the court, though, has to make specific findings as to her conduct on in order to make it relevant, in order to say, yes, on that date, here's what she did that I'm going to find is the relevant conduct, which I don't think that there's anything in the record as to that. The court does say that I think she's equally culpable. That's essentially a summation statement, but there isn't any facts laid out as to what her culpability was on November 12th. On November 12th, the items are found in a duffel bag in the roof attic, and they are squirreled away. The testimony at trial from the detective was some items are found in a bedroom. He's not sure where in the bedroom. The jury essentially didn't agree with the officer because they completely acquitted her of the count two, which is the possession of access devices on November 12th.
But the jury finding is really not the issue here. It's the sentencing judge's finding as to what's in the record in terms of the preponderance of evidence standard. So, I mean, the fact that the jury acquitted her, well, their findings are irrelevant, aren't they?
Well, I don't think it's irrelevant. I definitely think it's a factor that the court should look at to determine, in addition to what the district court ruled were the actual relevant conduct facts that go towards her actions on November 12th. And there aren't anything in the record here.
It seems to me that what we have to look at is whether the record, the evidence, setting aside the jury's determination, the evidence in the record supports the district court's finding, right?
Yes, which I don't believe there is. And
so the jury, whatever the jury decided, really doesn't have anything to do with that, does it? It's just we have to look at the record and see if it supports a finding by preponderance. Isn't that right?
Agreed. The jury also was essentially part of listening to that record, and I think that it supports my position that there isn't anything in the record that's the court identified that goes towards what she did, her conduct specifically on November 12th. It is a mere presence situation for November 12th. These items are merely found in her house. There's no statements. There's nothing that attributes her to actual conduct on November 12th. Additionally, judges, if I can raise the issue of sufficiency on the aggravated identity theft count. The court has a de novo review here, and the government had to prove that she knowingly possessed or used those two identities that were found and stolen on January 7th, that she knew they were of another person, and that she did it during in relation to some other felony. The timeline for January 7th is very critical here, so if I can briefly. Mm-hmm. The incidents take place, the thefts of these identities that we're talking about, the two people, Ms. Persaud and Ms. Chevreau, take place between 7:30 and 8:30 a.m. on January 7th. The car comes back to the house where Ms. Maitre is staying at about 8:30. The detective sees the car come back. The two drivers, the two people in the car, Mr. Smith and Mr. Pug, go in through the back of the house so that they can't be seen by Ms. Maitre, who then comes out through the front of the house a few moments later and gets in the car with her 12-year-old son and takes him to school. She's gone from 8:30 till about 10:10 in the morning. She comes back and goes in the house and is in the house for about 20 minutes, and then the detectives see them all leave together at 10:30 in the morning. The timeline...
Is this when they go to the dumpster?
Yes, this is when they go to the dumpster. The items that are found, the actual identity theft is the charge of the two particular people, Ms. Chevreau and Ms. Persaud. Those two identities are found squirreled away in a chair. It looks like a giant stiletto shoe. It's a great picture, but I don't have it here. And you have to flip the shoe upside down, unzip the material, the fabric that's covering the shoe, and in the heel of the shoe, the giant platform heel, you'll see a hollow space. And in there, there's a black satchel. And inside the black satchel is where these IDs are found, and Ms. Persaud and Ms. Chevreau's IDs are in there. Ms. Maitre is out of the house from 8:30 to at least 10:10. At best, she is in the same house as these identities for about maybe 15 minutes before she leaves and maybe 15 minutes after she comes back.
She drives her cohorts to the dumpster to dispose of Persaud's purse and a stolen license plate, right?
There, she does drive them, but there's no evidence that was presented here that she knew what was being discarded at the dumpster. There's no evidence that she knows of these two particular individuals and who they are and that they're...
You don't think that there's circumstantial evidence that when she takes the two guys to a dumpster where they throw these items in the dumpster that she's... you could reasonably infer that she knows why they're going to a dumpster?
Well, if one could infer that, did she know that there's something connected to a crime, that they're trying to get rid of it? I think that's a reasonable inference. But to specifically infer the identities of these two individuals, which is what she's charged with, the aggravated identity thefts, I don't think there's any facts that support that. The government had to show that she knew that these two folks, the timeline's critical here, that these were taken in the morning, and she's out of the house almost that entire time. And where they are placed, and Mr. Smith, who testified, said that she knew nothing of this. He hid them from her. And in fact, he hid them as soon as he came back and she left. The police, when they came in, they came back into the house with her. So there was really only about 15 minutes on each side of that morning where she leaves, where she would have had any opportunity to even know about this. And there's really no evidence in the record that supports it. I think that it's important, looking at Flores Figueroa, that the court look at the fact that she needs to know that these are also real people. There's nothing in the record that supports anything like that. In fact, there's nothing in the record that even supports she saw, held, possessed anything, these two particular individual identities.
Doesn't this go to the sort of the heart of the deliberate and ignorance charge? I mean, didn't the court, I mean, I know you're focusing very narrowly on these facts as part of your argument, but in reality, the court looked beyond that, sort of conduct in the days leading up, the way she drove from the house. I mean, isn't that sort of the basis that the district court relied on in providing that what I call the ostrich charge?
Well, I think the deliberate ignorance charge goes to the fact, and the court said it, which is that when she's denying knowing that what's going on, then the court felt that it was appropriate to give the deliberate ignorance charge in response to that, and that's actually in the record. I think that the jury had a lot of circumstantial evidence of different things happening, and they disregarded some of it because they acquitted her on one of the counts. I think it's important to look specifically for these aggravated identity thefts and figure out what are the elements and what are the facts that go to it. The timeline, as I said, is pretty critically important on January 7th, so I draw the court's attention to that timeline.
The problem you have on this is that instead that we've said an incorrect instruction on deliberate ignorance is harmless error when the jury was also instructed and could have convicted on an alternative sufficient theory of actual knowledge, and we have that here.
Well, I think that what happened here, though, is that I think if the court left it as to actual knowledge, we wouldn't really have that issue, because essentially that was the government's theory, was actual knowledge, that look at how much evidence there is, look at all these purses, look at these credit cards. She had to know because it was all over the place. I think when you add in the deliberate ignorance, it lowers the value of knowledge, not as to just the conspiracy, but also as to the aggravated identity thefts, which add 2 years to her sentence. And as I said, that timeline is very specific, and those elements are very specific.
One other thing before you sit down. Did you have the court reporter transcribe the jury instructions so they're in the they would be in the record for our review?
I'm CJA appointed, so I'm very cautious with the court's money, and that wasn't the issue of were they read right. The issue was it properly given in the first place, and those motions and that argument was in the record that we added as our appendix.
Okay. Do you have any questions? No. Thank you, Mr. Wahid.
Thank you.
Mr. DeRosa.
May it please the court, Philip DeRosa on behalf of the United States. I'd also like to introduce, seated with me at council table, is the lead trial attorney, AUSA Kerry Aronovitz. I think Mr. Wahid has answered the question of how you're going to address the deliberate ignorance instruction, because my first instinct was, I don't see how you could get behind the fact that he didn't order the oral charge to the jury. But if the sole issue is whether or not, if we all agree that the instruction was given, and if the sole issue is whether the instruction was properly given, I guess you would have to ignore the fact that he didn't order the oral charge.
You agree it was given.
Yes, ma'am. I think the record is clear that the deliberate ignorance instruction was given. It's interesting here that it was the defendant who triggered the giving of the deliberate ignorance instruction. The government didn't ask for it. She put on a witness that said that co-defendant Smith, her boyfriend, who said that she was totally unaware of everything that was in the house. And I understand that evidence went to...
When you say the defendant triggered it, are you saying that that caused the court to give it, or that the defendant asked for it to be given?
I think that the fact that she called that witness triggered
what prompted the court.
What prompted the court to give it, because the court said, you put on this witness that said that you didn't know anything about it, and yet because there was this sheer volume of the stolen items in the house, and the fact that many of them, at least on January 7th, 2015, were in plain view all throughout the apartment. The district judge even said you'd have to have been wearing a blindfold not to know that that stuff was there. And I think that the whole idea of wearing the blindfold is what made the judge think that the ostrich instruction, as Judge Hall called it, I've never heard that before, I like that, was appropriate. And let me just give a little bit of more texture to the sufficiency argument on the aggravated identity theft. This is a small house. That's clear from the record. There's no way anybody goes in there without anybody else in the house knowing that you're coming into the house. The defendant, co-defendant Willie Smith, and his co-defendant friend Daryl Pugh come back in the Chrysler 200 after engaging in at least 3 smash and grab robberies that morning. They come back to the house. She's there. Daryl Pugh walks into the house holding a black satchel with all kinds of stolen stuff in it from that morning. And she is there when he gets there. And as soon as they show up, she goes and gets into the burglary car, drives it away, goes through pylons on I-95 to escape what she knows is the surveillance that's been following her for more than a month. And the jury convicted her of being a part of the conspiracy. So she knows that they're stealing these things from real people. These purses that she's getting that her boyfriend claims are gifts, she knows that they come from real people. Now, as to the specific people whose identities were charged in counts 8 and 9, the aggravated identity charges, Lisa Chevron's purse was in plain view on the couch when the police came in to do their search on January 7, 2015. Lisa Chevron's driver's license wasn't in that purse. It was inside the zippered cushion of the chair. Natalie Persaud's Visa credit card was inside the chair also, and her purse was the one that the defendant took to the Family Dollar store and threw in the dumpster. There's no reason that she did that other than to dispose of evidence of a crime because she knew that that was a real person. And the circumstantial evidence that shows that she knew that those stolen items were in that chair were the fact that there was a gun in that chair as well, a .357 Ruger. The ammunition for that gun was in the defendant's underwear drawer. Now, her co-defendant, Willie Smith, said, you know, the cops must have put it there because it wasn't there, you know, originally. But she pled guilty. The government, in their rebuttal case, put a conviction on it, showed that she pled guilty to possessing that very ammunition on that very day. So it was in her drawer. She knew it. It fit the gun that was in the chair. So she knew the gun was in the chair. She knew that the gun was next to these stolen identifications. She knew that they were real people.
Can I ask you a question to refresh my memory? I looked at the indictment in this case, and I just can't remember. Did you all expressly charge her with aiding and abetting? Or, I mean, was that in the...
I believe that the two substantive charges of possession of 15 or more access devices was charged as an 18 U.S.C. charge. Yeah. And if Mr. Ronovitz has the indictment with him, do you remember, Terry? I read the indictment, and I thought I remembered seeing an 18 U.S.C.
He'll tell us.
Section 2.
He'll give us a thumbs up or thumbs down. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have it either. Okay.
Again, though, you know, we're not traveling on the aiding and abetting here. We're traveling on her actual knowledge and her...
I just was curious.
She was a principal in this, Your Honor. We believe that that's what the evidence has shown. With respect to the loss amount, I think it's important to remind the court here that this argument about the defendant being acquitted of the items that were stolen on November 12th, 2014, and therefore those items shouldn't have been considered by the sentencing court, he abandoned that argument. He made it in the district court, but he didn't argue that in his initial brief on appeal. That's why I didn't respond to it in my brief, because he didn't raise it. In fact, he conceded that some of the items that were taken on November 12, 2014, he said not all of those were access devices. So he conceded that those devices were being should be considered by the district court, but that not all of them. He resurrected the acquitted conduct argument in his reply brief, and by virtue of his recently filed what I think was supposed to be a notice of supplemental authority, which was the 1B1.3 relevant conduct. So, and I hesitate to cite cases on this, but I think it's clear from what Judge Pryor has said, it's settled law in this circuit that acquitted and uncharged misconduct is properly considered by the district court at sentencing as relevant conduct.
In every circuit?
I don't know, but I'll take your word for it, Your Honor. The thing about the loss amount that I wanted to get to is the driver's licenses, and I'm not sure that I should be going there because I don't think that he's raised it here in oral argument. I will say, though, that should be considered under a plain error standard because he raised it for the first time on appeal. And this court, neither this court nor the Supreme Court nor any other court that I know of in a published opinion, has said that driver's licenses can't be access devices, so he loses on plain error. Now, if this
was it even error? I mean, should we? So you're just saying we ought to dispose of it on that ground?
I'm saying that I want to get into that here, but I don't know if I can because he didn't raise it in his argument. If you want to ask
you certainly can raise something that then he'll have the opportunity to reply to and you won't have any rebuttal. But and it seems to me you've already done that, Mr. DeRosa. So
the district
if you want to say something about it, you can. It's of some interest to me. It seems to me that a driver's license would be an access device. I mean, the statute says that that if it's a card that can be used in conjunction with another access device, so let's say a credit card, to obtain money, goods, services, or any other thing of value, or that can be used to initiate a transfer of funds, then it's an access device. And, you know, I don't know about your experience, but I think it's common human experience in the United States that frequently when you use something like a credit card, a merchant will want to see your driver's license too.
I agree absolutely, Your Honor. The only thing I want to add is that I think it goes a little bit further than that. Under 1029E1, the definition of an access device, it says specifically a personal identification number. And that is what this court used in Wright to say that Social Security numbers were unequivocally access devices because under the statute, they reflected personal identification numbers. So it's not just the fact that a driver's license could be used in conjunction with another access device to obtain money or services. It's the fact that at least Florida driver's licenses, which are really the only ones that I'm familiar with intimately, have a personal identification number on them. That's what makes them an access device. It doesn't matter whether it's a standalone access device or not. But in that sense, driver's licenses are no different than Social Security numbers. So it seems to me that if you wanted to reach the merits of this on driver's licenses, Wright is the precedent that has established that a personal identification number can be used as an access device.
What about gift cards? Gift cards equal cash, don't they?
Just to back up a little bit right before I answer your question, the government, you know, In presenting its case at sentencing, considered all of the personal identifying information that was seized in this case, more than 1,500 items, as access devices. I have, whatever the merits of that position, and I'm not saying that...
Of what position?
Wrong. I'm just saying that I took a more conservative approach on appeals. I only used Wright to because Wright establishes that credit cards and debit cards are unquestionably access devices.
Got you to the 1,500.
Say again?
That got you to the 1,500 without relying on the gift card.
No, ma'am. There were only 38 gift cards, so you can throw those out if you want. You don't have to look at the gift cards. Awesome. The reason why I added those is because they have merchant account numbers on them, and Wright says that merchant account numbers are access devices.
I'm looking at the statute. If it's a card that can be used to obtain goods, it's an access device, right?
Yes, sir. And these, they're talking about 38 gift cards. You can call them store cards, value cards, reward cards. They're cards from Kohl's, JCPenney, AutoZone, Dunkin' Donuts. Like I say, there's only 38 of them. What gets the government over the limit on the number of cards is the driver's licenses. Because there's 760 credit and debit cards, there's 118 Social Security numbers, but without the 174 driver's licenses, we don't meet the number of 1,101 access devices, like I say, with or without the gift cards. The gift cards, there's only 38, they don't matter. We need 1,101 cards, because if you multiply that by 500, you get $550,500, and that's the range that the court found. So we need the driver's licenses. And like I say, it seems to me that this is a plain error argument, but if you want to go to the merits, then we stand on Wright. And if the court has no more further questions, I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. DeRosa. Mr. Wahid?
So if as the government says that you had to wear a blindfold not to see the things in this room, in this house, then why go with the willful blindness instruction, which lowers the standard and creates this whole problem? Which
I think he explained that what provoked that was that witness. Is that right?
What provoked that is the court sua sponte said this is what we should do. I think the defendant putting on a witness isn't the issue. The issue all along throughout the trial, even prior to that witness, was the question of knowledge. So that was not a new thing that was raised at that last, at the 11th hour at the defense case. It was through the crosses of all of the police officers. The fact that they're saying that these things were all over the house, first of all, to be clear, we're talking about on January 7th, not on the 12th, is where the officers say we find these in various places. But more importantly, that lower standard, the jury applies it to all the different counts, including the aggravated identity theft, including the actual possession of access devices on the 7th of January. As to the surveillance, the fact that the government is saying, well, she knows she's under surveillance, I don't think that is something that is proven anywhere. But even if one assumes that they're correct in that, the fact that she might know she's under surveillance doesn't, as they say, automatically go to the fact that she knows these are real people for the aggravated ID theft counts, which is the only thing I heard here. And the fact that she drove these folks to the dumpster, again, as I said earlier, I don't think that goes to the issue of does she know that these are real people. She was charged with the exact same counts as her co-defendant. So she was charged with the actual possession of, in the indictment, she's charged with the actual possession of 15 or more access devices in two of the counts. One of those counts she was acquitted, and the other count she was convicted. The issue of driver's license, the argument I made, Judge, is that there are a lot of items enumerated in 1029, and this isn't one of them. Driver's license are not included in there. It is that a lot of other things are enumerated in there very specifically, but a driver's license, so what ends up happening is you're double counting. So if you take my credit card, and you'll...
It does have the identification number, though, right? So, and under right, W-R-I-G-H-T, it does seem like it would qualify.
Well, I think that one would have to make the argument, first of all, that a driver's license on its own could get you something. So the question...
Now, if it has the personal identifying information, I think that it would count, wouldn't it, under right? I mean, the Social Security number counts, right?
Well, these items in conjunction with, if you have my credit card and that, but if you just have my driver's license or if you just have my social, I don't know that that should count. And I definitely think that even if you just have if you have my driver's license and a credit card, then the other argument problem there is you're now double counting for that same individual. This is really, we're going on the formula because there's no evidence anything was ever used here. But if the Congress wanted to specify driver's license, they could have easily added driver's license. It's a very common thing. This is not some new invention. This has been around for a long time, but it's not listed.
But they have a general definition, right? You can have a list, but the statute says that if you have a card, a driver's license is a card, isn't it? They can be used in conjunction with another access device to obtain money, goods, services, or anything of value.
I don't know that I would agree with the court that necessarily.
You've never had a merchant ask you for your driver's license when you use, say, a credit card?
Lately, no. I have a chip, Judge, and that's where we're at today.
I use okay.
But
I understand that we use chips. That doesn't really answer the question I had. Have you never, in your experience with merchants, had them ask for a driver's license?
Yes, several years ago. I'm sure I have. But the point I'm getting at when you're saying card, though, is that I don't know that driver's license is what we mean by card here. Card are, I believe, referring to cards that can get you resources, money, where the fact that a driver's license could have been on paper years ago as opposed to something hard and laminated. I think that term is somewhat misleading here. The real question is, why did Congress not specifically say driver's license? And I think that if they wanted to, they could have, and they still could, but they don't have that here.
But based upon that argument, aren't you saying Wright was wrongfully decided on the issue of Social Security numbers? Because, I mean, Social Security numbers are not specifically enumerated in that language.
Well, I think a Social Security number is different in that for one to be able to even get a bank account or credit cards or whatever, you're often asked for your social because they check your credit. I don't think that's the same with a driver's license. You're not checking your credit with a driver's license.
That's not the reasoning of Wright, though.
Understood, but I believe that the rationale of identification number, something that identifies you, the Social Security number is our identity. It is literally our identity, okay. Where I don't think a driver's license is the same.
Mr. Wahid, thank you. We have your case. We note that you were court appointed. We appreciate you accepting the appointment and assisting us today.
Thank you, judges.
Thank you.